Conference Committee for House File 2553 will come to order. You're probably all well aware that House and Senate conferees have shaken hands on terms of a conference report that we can bring back. And unless there's any other stated desire, I'm just going to have Mr. Gehring give a brief walkthrough of the agreement, which I think can be brief given that there's been certainly plenty of public discussion about it. We will have an opportunity for any testifiers for and against, and there may be an amendment, I guess, to the conference report that's offered. So we'll start with Mr. Gehring just giving a brief walkthrough of the conference report as it has been drafted.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the conference report is this one labeled TCR HF2553. Everybody should
Sorry,
have
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lass.
Do you want to let Mr. Gehring just review the whole thing without getting any questions or putting into questions later? Let the public then have any chance to hear about the conference report.
Mr. Senator Lass, that was my intent, is that he would just give us a run through, and if there are questions, we can take them from the committee first.
Thanks.
Senator Bethel. Mr. Gehring, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, Section 1 of the bill provides that if an individual decides that instead of the fund process that's being set up in this bill, they decide they would like to go through the civil process and sue the state, the tort liability caps that were in effect as of January 1st of 2008 are now effective retroactively to August 1st of 2007, so that would increase the individual liability limit to $400,000 per person, up from $300,000 per person. Section 2 establishes the basic purpose for the 35W bridge collapse fund process. Section 3 provides definitions for the terms used throughout the bill. Section 4 is the first substantive section in the bill. It sets up a process for individuals to make a claim to the state for funding. There are two pots of money that are allocated for the process. The first pot is a $24 million account from which a special master panel set up of three individuals appointed by the Supreme Court. The individuals on the panel must be attorneys, would distribute funds based on the calculated damages of claimants to the fund. An individual survivor would be eligible for up to $400,000 from this fund. There's also a second pot of money. $12.64 million has been allocated as a supplemental payment fund. An individual who has total damages in excess of $400,000 as calculated by the special master panel, would be eligible to request a supplemental payment. Supplemental payments would be available to pay for damages in excess of the $400,000 cap and to cover uncompensated medical expenses and also loss of income or future earning capacity or other financial support that would be lost that was not covered by the first $400,000. The supplemental payment program would prioritize uncompensated medical expenses, and any loss of income funding through the supplemental payment program could not be allocated until all individuals have been fully paid for medical expenses in excess of the $400,000 cap. If it turns out there's not enough funding in the supplemental payment fund to cover all of the expenses, survivors would be eligible for a payment on a pro-rata basis. There's language that's fairly technical in the bill related to release. In order to receive a payment from the fund, a survivor would need to release the state from legal liability, so basically they would agree to not sue the state for the bridge collapse. There are deadlines specified in the conference report for the submission of claims. An individual survivor would have until October 15th of 2008 to submit a claim to the special master panel, and offers of settlement would have to be provided no later to the individual survivors no later than February 28th of 2009. And finally, there's an appropriation of $610,000 for White House to address the needs of the children that were on the school bus that was on the bridge at the time of the collapse.
Questions from the conference?
Did you want to get into detailed stuff now?
Well, I think maybe we should just start with some. If there's discussion from the committee now, I think that would be better, and we can then entertain public discussion. Spencer Lane.
Mr. Chair, we have before us a proposed conference committee report, which has the intent of memorializing the agreement which was reached at the end of last week between the House and the Senate conferees. Of course, the agreement was about half of a page in detail. We were working through drafts and reviewing drafts of the proposed conference committee report yesterday and today, it became apparent that there, to me anyway, that there were some details in the proposed conference committee report that did not accurately reflect or did not in sufficient detail reflect the concept of the agreement that we had reached the end of last week. One of those, and I've got a number of notes, and part of this is just a matter of not everyone being able to catch up at the same time to our House and Senate counsel that were working seriously and diligently over the weekend to put this together. So some of the stuff we might have been able to address more technically over the weekend if we'd all been able to get together at the same time in that regard. Let me maybe raise a couple of suggestions for language clarification, and then there are a couple of ones which I think are relatively not difficult to deal with. There was, if we can turn to Section 5, with regard to the special compensation process, my cross references are the same from the previous draft that I looked at until now. And if you look at on page 8, subdivision 4, paragraph B, there is a provision that subrogation claims, or that parties that are claiming a subrogation interest have to notify the state. Basically, they've got 40 days to do that, to indicate if they were going to notify that they intend to assert a subrogation claim. Yet there is another provision, and I think it's line on page 6, line 6.3 in, let me check here. The 45-day payment, there we go, on page 7, line 7.6, where it states that the Commissioner of Finance shall pay within 45 days. Now, counsel is pointing out to me there's an except as sub 4 paragraph B, so we take care of that question. So basically it means that they have to wait at least 40 days, unless they receive a notice earlier than that. Before they make the payment, so there's adequate time for the potential subrogation interest to notify. We didn't want a situation where they were actually making a payment out on day 30, but the subrogation interest could wait until day 40 to send in a notice they were going to subrogate. It seems to have taken care of that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lapp, yep, this does include a cross-reference to that subrogation paragraph. But it doesn't specifically address the situation where the commissioner might make a payment earlier. It's just they have to assert the subrogation interest within 40 days.
It looks to me like, you know, these are some technical issues, but it looks to me like we should specify if we're going to give 40 days for a subrogation interest to notify that they intend to pursue their subrogation. We don't want to be in a position where the Commissioner of Finance is making payments on day 30. Basically, you're going to have a waiting period at least through that notice period before the Commissioner can issue a check.
Representative Silver.
Mr. Chair, if you put in there that the commissioner cannot make a payment before the 40 days, then if they have been notified that there is not going to be no subrogation, then they have to wait also. So, I mean, if they're notified, then why can't he make the payment if there's not going to be a subrogation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, I agree with that. And maybe there's some way to say that they've got to wait until at least 40 days have passed unless they are notified earlier that there will not be a subrogation interest pursued. But I don't know that we require that a notice come in they're not going to pursue subrogation, only that they are going to pursue a subrogation. Or we could say they've got to notify within 30 days, and then there's a 15-day window after which the payment will be made if they haven't indicated a subrogation desire.
And subject to advice from counsel in either chamber, but it seems to me that by referencing that section and putting that language in there, the intent seems to be fairly clear to me, I guess. And I'd hate to, given that we're trying to accomplish this in a fairly quick order, if we draft language kind of on the spot and insert it here, I'm a little bit concerned about that. I'm comfortable, I guess, with the intent as it is written being clear. But I'd defer to Mr. Gehring or Ms. Pontius or Mr. Watson or Shepherd, for that matter, on their thoughts.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Kahn.
I'll give you an uneducated thought before you get the learned thought. It seems to me we're not dealing with really innocent people who have no knowledge of the law and how it works in financial matters. And it seems to me anyone reading this who was interested in filing a subrogation claim would clearly be advised to do it as quickly as possible. There's nothing here. You know, I don't think they would see that there was this ability for, and I think if even questions were being asked about it, I think the Commissioner of Finance would probably not rush to do the payment at 30 days if he saw that there was the possibility of subrogation changes.
I see thoughtful expressions on both sides.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Shai.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, I'm assuming also that the master panel will see this and understand, but I'd be more comfortable if there were some more attention drawn to it I think you could do it with a sentence, but that I leave to people, you know, with better minds than mine on drafting that specific language, but I think we should address it. I don't think we should assume something here.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Silver.
I think with the record of the tape today to the special masters, we've drawn attention to it.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Watson.
Also, what that language at the bottom of page 8 says, that the person who has a subrogation claim and is claiming an interest has 40 days after the settlement agreement was entered into to provide notice to the state and the survivor of the person's intent to assert that interest, during which time, that is the 40 days, the Commissioner of Finance must not make the payment.
Oh.
I don't know how you can be more clear than that.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Watson, for resolving that. Mr. Lass, your next point.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Watson. So I guess they'll have a five-day window then in which they will have to get that check out the door. Is that going to be sufficient for the Commissioner of Finance?
It will be.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
Senator Lass.
My next question can be found on page 9. I might struggle with some of my cross-references because earlier versions had different page and line numbers that I was reviewing. There's a paragraph C under subdivision 5, so lines 9.21 to 9.29 have to deal with subrogation or reimbursement of the state. And it is a standard tort law for the state that if they make payments out to someone in settlement of a claim and then that party recovers from another defendant, another tortfeasor for the same damages, that the state then has a right to be reimbursed for that. So the injured party does not receive double recovery for a single loss. And there was some earlier language in drafts and in the bill that came out of the Senate that was a little, I think it overextended that reach. I think the idea under current state law is that the state is not entitled to its reimbursement for payment that is already made until after the injured party has been fully compensated for their loss. It would be, certainly was my intent, that be the same approach here. The language that is here, however, and the language which came out of the Senate, which I think was overreaching, said that the state could only then receive reimbursement from any payments that were made in excess of full compensation. And then, so if someone gets fully compensated under the calculations by the special master, and then if they receive additional compensation by a third-party defendant, maybe some other definition of full compensation is reached in the course of that litigation, only then does the state get reimbursed. But it seemed to me that the current law is once they are fully compensated, then the state should be entitled to get reimbursed for payments that helped enable that full compensation, and it would come out of whatever that full compensation amount is. The language that's on 9.28 to 9.29 provides for the state to be reimbursed only to the extent that the payments are greater than the total damages incurred by the survivor. So in a sense, then, you end up with the survivor getting double recovery for the same loss. They've been paid by the state, and they've been paid by another party up to the level of full compensation. They might have gotten paid more by the other defendant in excess of the full compensation, but they've received double compensation up to that level. And so it was my goal was to simply apply current state law the way it applies to other tort cases. Once they reach full compensation, the state's entitled to reimbursement.
I think that's what it
I think line 9.27 to 9.29, maybe I'm reading it wrong, I'm happy to be corrected by counsel. The state is entitled to be reimbursed by a survivor only to the extent that these payments are greater than the total damages incurred by the survivor.
But I think that includes all of the payments.
Yeah, and Representative Senator Lass, I guess I don't see ambiguity. I think we should defer to counsel, research staff.
Mr. Chairman, it seems perfectly clear to me, but if it's not clear to somebody else,
it's not clear to me. Mr. Chair, Mr. Watson, when it says reimbursement only to the extent the payments are greater than the total damages incurred by the survivor, then when does or out of which amount does the state's reimbursement come?
Well,
mean, if the total loss, if the total damages are calculated to be $1 million, and the injured person gets $1 million, at that point, do they have to reimburse the state for the state's portion of that payment, or only if they get $1.2 million, and then the state's payment comes out of that $0.2?
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lapp, the first sentence there in line 9.21 has the survivor notifying the state if the survivor has been fully compensated by third parties. I think that's what we're talking about, the amount that is received from third parties. And the second sentence is the measure of when there is fully compensated. And to the extent that these payments, that is the payments from the third parties, are greater than the total damages, then the money goes back to the state. The state has a right to be reimbursed, so that the survivor is only getting a total that's equal to the total damages incurred. That's how I read it.
Okay. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Mr.
Watson. So they're only getting a total equal to the total damages incurred as defined by the panel? Is that the way you read it?
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chairman. It is the panel who determines the total damages.
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lott, I'd also point out on page 5 for calculating the amount of damages that can be paid by the panel. So the panel is required to offset the total damages that they would pay based on any settlement agreement that the survivor would get from a third party. So to the extent that there is an agreement or some other third party paying funds to the survivor in calculating the damages and thus calculating the awards that they would get from the state, that amount of money would have to be discounted from the state's payment.
Mr. Gehring, if that happens before the state makes the payment, right?
Right.
If it happens after the state makes the payment, there's the reimbursement that I'm concerned about. But if the if both counsel is satisfied that the intent is reflected in the language, I will leave it at that. Okay.
Record will show that counsel were nodding their heads responsibly.
Let's see, one of my other concerns was addressed between the last draft that I saw and this draft. I should ask counsel, Mr. Chair. I should ask counsel if there's there was a provision or a discussion at one of our previous conference committee meetings about ensuring that that individuals, that some payment was made on the non-economic loss for those individuals that had relatively minor injuries and actually didn't suffer any economic loss. Representative Winkler had raised this question. Someone hurt their arm, didn't miss any days at work, and didn't really have any uncompensated medical expenses, but they might have had some pain and suffering that was related to that, and that would be compensable under ordinary tort claims. In the previous Senate offer, we had included some language that would indicate that the special master panel must make some payment on all claims that meet the criteria for damages, loss, and survivors definitions, but must pay all economic loss first and then non-economic loss. And this is memorializing the discussion that we had at the last conference committee meeting. Except when only non-economic loss is suffered, and then some payment must be made on the non-economic loss. Is there language in this conference committee report to reflect that?
Gary?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lett, I don't think that specific language is in here. The definition of damages is the Senate definition, which includes all damages that would be compensable under state tort law. So the panel is allowed to award damages based on that definition, but that specific language isn't included in the bill.
And I guess, go ahead, Senator.
Well, I was just saying, Mr. Chair, that the last conference committee meeting that we all had together, there was discussion on this very point, and the chair had raised this issue, wanting to make sure that everyone who made a claim who would qualify for a claim would at least get some award, and that the panel wouldn't simply say, if you didn't have any non-economic loss, you weren't going to get anything. Or if you didn't have any economic loss, you weren't going to get anything. So we attempted to reflect that in our last offer. I think it was actually in writing, because I've got the language that I pulled off of that, which specified we had some discussion about prioritization within the claims. And the language was that the panel must make some payment on all claims that meet the criteria, but must pay all economic loss, past and future, first, then non-economic loss, except when only non-economic loss was suffered, then some payment must be made on the non-economic loss. And so I guess I'd propose that we include the language that reflects Chair Winkler's suggestions at the last conference committee meeting.
Senator, I guess I think it's important that there be discretion to this panel to fashion the remedy based on the appropriation that they have. And I guess I would hesitate before we, and I know that we had this discussion at some point, but I would, you know, I think that language based, that we have, and I think there is language to this effect, essentially saying that they should take whatever steps are necessary within the confines of this bill to create equitable settlement agreements for the individuals who bring claims. And I think that the importance of non-economic loss is not, the importance of economic losses aren't reflected in the structure of the bill with the supplemental payments. I think we're better off with the special master panel having some discretion to fashion rules that are going to use the resources that we've given them most effectively. But I would suggest that we not include that language, though I did raise the issue in the past. I think using the definition of the tort definition of damages is a reasonable approach, and I think it's consistent with our discussions we've had since that time. And I guess we should have a motion to adopt the conference report, and then we can. We have the report before us. So, Representative Kahn moves to adopt the conference report, and now we can, if you want to suggest changes to it, then at least it's before us.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you had raised the issue before, and I was attempting to address that. I agreed with the point that you had raised in terms of prioritization of the losses. And in terms of ensuring that everyone who qualified at least got something. I don't have a page and line number for an amendment to this effect. I don't know if counsel does or not. I would offer an amendment to accomplish that. You know, I've got a fair amount of faith in the panel's discretion, too. On the other hand, we're making decisions here, and to the extent that we can be clear as to the intent of the conference committee, I think that can only be helpful to the panel's determinations.
So, Senator Latch, is that a motion to ask counsel to produce language to that effect and insert it at the appropriate place?
Yes.
Okay. Discussion to that motion. Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I would strongly oppose this. We know this has been a tortured path to arrive at this agreement. I think we know that leadership has asked us that the reason that we're meeting today and not tomorrow or anything like that is so that we can get this signed and get it on the House desk tonight. Any changes that we make obviously interfere with that. And unless if it was something that I thought could not be handled by the special master, then I would be more likely to agree with it. But I think there are very good reasons why we want to give a fair amount of discretion to that panel, and I don't think they need, when you look at the interest that has been in this and the attention that's been paid to it, I don't think they're going to screw it up, frankly. Much less likely than we would be making last minute arrangements at this time.
Other discussion? Representative Bessel?
Well, Mr. Chair, if we have proposed language, I think that's more properly before us. We don't normally vote on something to direct council to draft when they come back to us. We ask council to do it, and if they come up with some language, we'll look at it if it makes sense. So I don't know why they'd be voting on if there's a motion before us right now.
Well, we will.
I'm open, obviously, to improve the proposal we have before us, and if there's some language that is suggested, I think we should be open, taking a look at it.
Okay, why don't we have...
We don't have any language right now.
Why don't we have Ms. Council, I guess, probably Ms. Pontius, take language. I think there has been language developed in the past. I don't know if she has it with her or not, but we can get that before us, and we will not vote on that, the motion as expressed. So I guess we can then go into Senator Lackey's next point, and then we can... put that aside and come back to it.
Okay, maybe council could also inform me then. We had a discussion about making sure that the special master panel made its distribution decisions with the understanding that there would be no future appropriation and should notify the survivors of that point when extending the settlement offers. Is there any language in this conference committee report to that effect?
Mr. Gehring or Ms. Pontius?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Lass, it's on page 4, on lines 19 to 22.
Perfect.
Okay.
Thank you.
Are you fine? Senator Lass?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Lass.
There was also discussion at one point regarding the timing of the availability of the emergency relief funds to the survivors and when that would expire, and so on. Perhaps council can direct me to the provision because I don't have a section and subdivision reference in front of me where that is identified. Council's informing me, Mr. Chair, that maybe there's nothing in here in this draft. At some point along the way, there were some drafts that reflected a comment or a provision that the funds available under the Emergency Relief Fund would be available to the survivors only up until a certain date, such as when an offer was extended by the Special Master Panel. And I don't see anything in this a conference committee report to that effect, although I've seen it in previous drafts that we had looked at. What I would propose
here is Representative Silver 5, line 13, as part of the calculation of the amount.
Mr. Chair, that's just the offset for any payments already made by the Emergency Relief Fund. Well, let me tell you what I was going to suggest.
What about line 5.4?
And Representative Kahn. Representative Kahn, I think what Senator Lass was talking about is that in previous drafts we've had language stating when the Emergency Hardship Fund would cease to make emergency hardship payments. And I think that there's council telling us that there isn't language in this current draft that reflects
that previous discussion.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me suggest what I think appropriate provision to that effect would be and see if it meets with any concurrence here on the conference committee. I would suggest that we specify that the funds under the emergency relief fund be available until a settlement is accepted and payment is made. Of course, the settlement provisions would have to reflect the anticipated payment to that
language
to that period. Huh? And it would not be available after the settlement offer was rejected. So if someone opted not to accept the settlement offer and to sue the state instead, they would no longer be able to draw on the emergency relief fund for support. And then the state would retain the right of repayment if the claimant did receive future compensation from the state or any other party for losses connected to the bridge collapse.
Representative Tom.
As I recall, that emergency relief fund was something that was just set up by the executive without any legislative input into it. So it seems to me the executive can just take care of what happens with that.
Representative Tom, there was a legislative input through the claims committee. But I think that the governor probably did have the authority to do that, despite the fact that he in fact asked for that. So it may be that language to that effect.
It's obviously not necessary if the governor could do it without. I don't care even if the claims committee said it was a good idea. It doesn't become legislative action until it's passed by both houses and signed into law.
That's right.
So it's just an executive action. So you know, if the governor think that that's so necessary or doesn't. Again, there aren't a lot of, well, I can say that. I don't want to say anything yet. But the, I guess I would fully trust the governor's office to deal with this in a fiscally appropriate manner. That was pretty good, David.
That's on the record, too.
I mean, I was going to preface it with something that wasn't that nice, but I could quote myself.
Senator Moore.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I understand that the governor's office did come up with that as a way to do emergency response, but we have an opportunity here to insert that language, and maybe we should talk about whether or not, regardless of what the governor chooses to do, whether or not we as a part of this bill should address that. And I think Senator Lass raises a good question for us to think. I wouldn't want to just dismiss it because the initiation of the fund was initiated by the governor's office. If there's an opportunity to do something here, I'm under the misimpression that our purpose here was to sign the conference committee report. And I guess I'm concerned then that we agreed to the broad picture, but lots of details have been worked out in the meantime, and I'm a little bit concerned that we're not moving forward with the impression that this is not changeable, that we can't have input into. I mean, the intent is not to undo all of this, members, but I hope that we're, you know, this is a process where we all as members have an opportunity to get all the details that have been worked on for the last 2 days, and if a good idea pops up by any members, we ought to give it some consideration. So, my thinking is that if, and I'm not on either side of it, I just think that I hadn't thought about this one point, and if we could put those constraints on it, I'm not necessarily opposed to it, just because the governor is the one who initiated the fund to begin with.
Senator Lass, I guess one question is, do you have language to this effect? And there are, I guess, as I heard you...
Mr. Chairman, I don't have specific language right now. I guess I want to avoid the situation where someone could, who is drawing on a weekly basis from the Emergency Relief Fund, and there are some of those who have done, who could decide to reject an offer of settlement, yet continue to draw on that Emergency Relief Fund, and, you know, on into the future. And there's no language here to prohibit that. Now, maybe the governor would decide unilaterally we're not going to allow that to happen, but we have a policy choice in front of us in that regard as well. So we can add some language to clarify that.
Representative Tom.
I thought there were limits in that emergency fees. I thought that there were some people that may have already even exhausted those limits. I thought, and you know if there is anybody.
I thought, Representative Tom, Senator Lass, you may remember better, but I thought it was up to $25,000.
Mr. Chairman, the initial, there are dollar limits in there. It was originally up to $10,000, subject to the availability of funds, and then it was raised to $20,000, also subject to the availability of funds. That was, you know, a discretionary decision by the governor. The only other limit was on the appropriation for the fund out of which that money was made available, which was a previously appropriated tort claims fund under the trunk highway laws from the budget bill a year ago.
Well, Representative Tom, I guess I think
I mean, we're talking about, well,
if there is language that we can easily incorporate, this was in previous draft, and is, I think, something that we had, it was in both bills that had passed on. I think it's reasonable to have that considered, at least, if they can put the language together and bring it before us. So, I'm like you, I would like to try to get this signed and done, but there is, it seems like this was something that was there previously and may have just been missed. Representative Tom.
I still don't think it's something that was necessary. We're looking at pools of funds that are an order of magnitude times two apart. And I just don't think they're comparable. Plus I think that the governor had, you know, would have the ability to stop it. If it ended up, it turned out there was some kind of, I guess when you look at the different numbers that we're looking at, the different kinds of numbers, and the fact that that fund has a termination, and that the amounts, and that the limits were so small on that fund, it's really hard, even if it was in both drafts, it's really hard to do the two that's necessary.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we're kind of in the awkward circumstance here where, you know, we didn't kind of work through the side-by-side and collectively address these kind of details over the course of conference committee meetings. We adjourned for a while and we reached a agreement in principle on the broad outlines, and now we're being presented with a proposed conference committee report, which we all hope we can sign and get off to the floor tomorrow. But I don't think we should abrogate our responsibility to try to work through some of the details and make sure we agree with and understand the language that council has worked on over the last 2 days.
Okay.
So maybe we can come up with some language to that effect. We can continue with the discussion, and council maybe can work on a little bit of language to that effect as well. I don't know if you want to circle back on that, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I think we will have to. You know, I don't know if you have, I guess.
Well, I can just propose this. The emergency relief funds are available until a settlement offer is accepted and payment is made, period. Those funds are not available after a settlement offer has been rejected, period. The state retains its right of repayment if the claimant receives future compensation from the state or other party or another party for losses connected to the bridge collapse. Period.
Does council have that language? Ms. Pine? Or Ms. Watson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think I have a copy of it on my desk. but I'm sorry.
Well, Mr. Chairman, inquiry, would that be then a new subdivision on page 7 after line 17? Is that what you're talking about, Senator Lass?
Sure.
Senator Lass.
Well, we are in the position, I guess, of having to get to the, if we do amend this report, we will have to have a new copy drafted and prepared for signature, which I'm not sure if the revisor will be able to do, depending on the extent we make those changes or not. But that's something to consider. I don't know if you want to read that language again or pass it to Ms. Pontius so that they could at least have a language so we have something specific that we could vote on.
Well, I can certainly repeat it, or I can write it down here. I have most of it essentially written down already. The funds available under the Emergency Relief Fund are only available until a settlement offer is accepted and payment is made, period. The Emergency Relief Funds are not available after a settlement offer has been rejected, period. The state retains its right of repayment if a claimant receives future compensation from the state or another party for losses connected to the bridge collapse, or to the catastrophe, I guess, as we were referring to that. So I'd move to amend page 7 after line 17 by inserting a subdivision 16 to that effect.
Is there a way we can get that copied? If you got it, how do you have it handwritten or something, or what do we have?
Mostly,
that's
Mr. Chairman, it's mostly typed out here, but I put it into actual sentences when I read it.
And then, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Shai.
Chairman, I have a question. That section, that subdivision, is about the election to proceed in district court, I think, and I don't know that this. I mean, it ties to this, but that's only one part of it, I think. You really want some kind of you're interested in a
new
subdivision. It would be a new subdivision.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Okay. I'm sorry. I thought maybe you could do it in the definition, but maybe not.
Senator Bethel?
Why don't we get the issues out there and, you know, just set it aside if there's other issues, and you know, if we need a couple minutes recess to actually type it out, that shouldn't take too long, and put it before us. You know, I think I feel better about actually seeing the words here before I vote on something. So,
very well, we will continue with Mr. Senator Lass's additional questions, or certainly if other members do as well, and we'll come back to that if we need to when we are prepared to.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, on Section 5, Subdivision 6, I was having some trouble understanding what the purpose of that subdivision is. It might just have been my obtuseness at midnight last night as I was reviewing everything, but I need to ask counsel to clarify.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lass, I did add, if you look on page 9, line 32, added the $1 million before the reference to limit, so it's clear what those other cross-references are. So this provision was just intended to make it clear that if, in fact, parties did bring a separate action in district court, that any payments that were made under this special compensation process would not be factored into that $1 million limit on state tort claims. And that was the purpose of the language.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Pontius, how would they bring a special action in district court after they've received payments under the special compensation process if they'd be releasing all liability?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lutz, they couldn't if they'd already... This would be for people who didn't sign a release who were then proceeding to district court or didn't accept an offer or else just chose to go straight to district court.
Okay, so their payments, Mr. Chair, so let's say someone got $30,000 from the Emergency Relief Fund. They did not accept the offer of settlement, they decided to sue the state instead, that $30,000 would not be applied toward the aggregate $1 million cap that generally applies and is being waived only for the settlement purposes here? Is that what this says?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it would still be subject to the, what would be under this proposal, the $400,000 cap. But it's, so it's just for purposes of the $1 million aggregate cap that it wouldn't apply.
So, Ms. Pontius, if in the event that there were, you know, 20 survivors who decided not to accept this and to sue otherwise, I guess that's when this subdivision would be, or that this language would be relevant.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. So the $400,000 cap would still apply to those people. But all the other payments that were made under either this special process or the emergency relief fund would not go into that $1 million determination.
And Senator Lass, I'm sorry.
You can hand the gavel over if you wish.
I'll think about it. Senator Lass, the language, I think, was in the original Senate bill. So not something we're going to weigh in on.
No, it might have been, but I was hoping maybe for a little clarification. All right, I'll move on.
Senator Lass.
Let's see here. And on page 3, oh, I'm sorry, I think I got my page wrong here. Where's the list of the offset? There we go. I'm sorry. Page 5, subdivision 10, under calculation of amount. One of the there's been a source of funds to the survivors that is not listed in the 3 collateral source offset categories from lines 5.11 to 5.17. And that's funds which have been paid by community organizations, charitable organizations, and at least in particular the United Way Fund. The latest information we have is that about $469,000 has been distributed from the United Way Fund to individuals. I'm not talking institutions such as White House, which have also received support, but to individuals to assist them on things like mortgages and car replacement or whatever their rent, those kind of immediate needs. The same kinds of things which a damages payment from a tortfeasor would be intended to pay for, and the same kind of things the Emergency Relief Fund was intended to assist. And so I'm going to raise the question as to whether or not we wish to consider including as a collateral source offset from what the state pays, payments also received from other community organizations. The theory would be the same, which is that the state is kind of the payer of last resort from that standpoint, because we're using taxpayer dollars. So we tend not to pay when a health insurer has made a payment for medical losses. We offset for those health insurance payments. When a no-fault insurance payment has made wage loss payments up to their $20,000, we offset for that. So even though, if this were not the state being involved in normal tortfeasor, the tortfeasor would pay for those things. The state, using taxpayer dollars as a general matter of policy in all its tort settlements, subtracts for those other sources that are paid. So I want to raise the question for consideration whether we should likewise subtract from payments that were made to the individuals by other community organizations. They've already got the payments. Presumably they're not intending to return those payments once the state pays a settlement for the same losses. So I'll toss that out for consideration.
Representative Solberg.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, I hope we don't go down that road. There's a difference between a payment from an insurance company and a payment from a charity, or when we hold our pancake fundraiser to help a family in my community, we don't expect if they get a settlement that they pay back the people who have given to the provided the charity for the pancake fundraiser. I think all of us give to charity all the time, and we expect that to meet some needs But if they don't meet that specific need and they give it to a family, I expect them to use it. I don't want to say that they should be ever being reimbursed for my gift that I give to charity. And I think the United Way is a charity organization.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Sachs.
Mr. Chairman, I know, Senator Lacks, if you said that this is normally done in calculating an award in the tort claim, is that you're saying that you would take away what a church group gave or a food shelf or United Way or that kind of a nonprofit or charitable organization? Are those payments or contributions usually considered a collateral source? I mean, is that...
Mr. Chairman, I'm not saying that it's already written into existing state law. I'm raising the question of whether it's comparable in terms of policy to offset, basically to protect the use of the taxpayer dollars to cover losses that are not already covered by some other source. And if some of the losses are covered by a community organization, a charitable organization, it's another source just like, you know, other sources are. So I'm raising the question as to whether or not we ought to consider that.
But
there may be reasons why we choose not to do that, but I thought it was a question worth considering.
And I'm sure with Senator West, I'm not particularly comfortable going there because I think it's really hard, first of all, to enforce and to differentiate between the kinds of contributions that may be made to an individual or to a family and what the money was used for. I mean, I just don't think we would want to go there at this time.
I just threw out the question for consideration. So,
and we have heard two contrary, I guess, suggestions. Are there anybody who wants to offer the pro? Representative? No.
The irony, Mr. Chair, is that I actually did have an amendment drafted in case there was some interest in this, but it doesn't sound like there is, so I'm not going to offer the amendment.
Okay. Senator Lacks, do you have... Anything further?
I do, Mr. Chairman, but I think I would like to have an opportunity to discuss with the Senate conferees the other issue, which I have, you and I had some discussion before coming in here about it, and I think I'd like to discuss it with my Senate conferees before we go any further with that additional thought.
Very well.
I'd ask for a recess.
Senator, we are in recess. We are reconvening the Council Committee for House File 2553. I'd like to recognize Representative Tan.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I made the motion to accept the Conference Committee report. Now, we do have some minor changes which are going to be easily made, and so I'd like to withdraw my motion to accept the Conference Committee report at this time.
And do you have a motion to adopt the Conference Committee report?
Do we have the new one from? Is this the new one?
We do have a new one.
It's
2553A.
I don't have it.
There's only three copies.
There's only three copies,
okay.
And they're fine. They're ready to go.
Okay. Yes.
Could you explain?
We will explain it.
Yes. I would like to move now that we now accept the revised Conference Committee report with 2553A.
And the members, the substantive changes that have been adopted in this new draft are that it's clarifying that in the supplemental pool, each of the three categories are going to be distributed on a pro rata basis, which is clarifying in language the intent of our agreement previously. And secondly, we have changed the language to specify that it will be the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and not the Supreme Court at its discretion that will appoint the Special Master Panel. Those are the substantive changes in this version. There are two other issues which some of us have discussed and I think need to be stated for the record. The first is that there is a concern that payments made pursuant to a compensation fund may affect individuals' ability or families' ability to receive public assistance dollars in the future. It may affect their eligibility. We are not going to attempt to address that in this bill right now without the substantive knowledge and ability to have relevant parties here to weigh in on that change, but there is a commitment to try to address that in another bill this session. Secondly, there is the language in the bill as drafted right now requires future medical expenses as reasonably calculated to be paid out through the compensation fund. The language also requires that health insurance companies continue to make payments for those same medical conditions in the future. So in a sense, the language as drafted now may create a double recovery for health insurance claims. We're not necessarily under the impression that we can prevent in all cases any kind of double recovery under any circumstance, but we have made a commitment from both chambers to try to address that concern and try to the extent possible limit any amount of double recovery consistent with the unpredictability of coverage for future health care coverage. So we will try to address that again this session in another bill to the extent we can do so. And if there are other comments on changes we have made or issues we've raised since the previous draft, I would welcome those from the committee at this time. Seeing none, there is an opportunity for the public to weigh in for or against this conference report. Seeing none of that, Representative Kahn renews her motion that the Conference Committee for House File 2553 adopt the conference report. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Thank you, members. We will have the committee report signed and delivered to the desk of the House tonight so that it can be passed off the House floor. The conference report can be passed off the House floor tomorrow, along with the then sent to the Senate and passed off tomorrow as well, is my understanding of the intention, so that we can move this as quickly as we possibly can. I want to thank everyone who has worked very diligently and very hard and creatively to try to fashion a solution that I think meets the state of Minnesota's responsibilities to the survivors, to the taxpayers, and to future officers of government who have to deal with whatever we put forward in law. So thank you for that. Now, your other comments before we adjourn.
Mr. Chair, why don't we just stay in place? Maybe you can send two copies of the report, one direction, one the other, and then we'll just reverse course so we can get them all signed and make some reasonable order of the matter before we adjourn, or after we adjourn, I don't care.
I think we can adjourn and then sign.
And then sign, yeah. Why don't we adjourn and then sign them? But just stay here.
Mr. Chair, I just want to personally thank our the staff who have done a lot of work on this. I think they spent, I know Ms. Pontius on the Senate side has just spent countless hours, as is I'm sure staff on the House side. And we are so lucky to have such good staff who have been so willing to really go the extra effort to try to accommodate our visions and desires for the kind of outcome that we have, and I just want to thank you both very much for that.
Senator Moore, I would only add that this, especially that is true on an issue, on a bill that is so technical and complex, and in addressing a situation that we haven't had to address before. So in addition to the hard work, diligence, and everything else, we're very fortunate to have such intelligent and competent and capable people doing the work for us.
And Mr. Chair, I think we also need to thank the those affected by this tragedy, you know, who've come to meetings. You know, not all are here tonight, of course. I do want to cite my own two constituents, Mrs. Sather and Mrs. Holmes. They're here tonight. They've been here virtually every meeting and so forth. I thank them for, you know, their patience.
And let me add the final thank you to the ability to work miracles from the revisor's office.
If there's nothing further, we are adjourned.